Track 3.
Tom tried to keep his attention on the con of the ship, respond to Ned's inquisition, and watch for the moment that Caroline opened her songbook and found the note he had placed between the pages. "Mizzen mast sails, if you please, from the top," said Ned. "Mizzen topsail," Tom replied, then hesitated. Caroline was ready to sing, and Walsh passed her the songbook. "Go on," Ned encouraged him. "Mizzen staysail," said Tom, and paused again. Caroline opened the book and frowned. She was reading something between the pages. He thought he saw her pale, but then she glanced up involuntarily and looked straight at him across the full length of the open deck. "Mizzen course," said Tom, and looked back at her. Again she gave him that sly, enigmatic look and tossed her head so that her curls danced in the wind. From between the pages of her songbook, she picked up the scrap of rice paper on which she had so laboriously penned his message, crumpled it into a ball between her fingers, and tossed it disdainfully over the side. The wind caught it and carried it far out before dropping it into the water, where it disappeared among the purling white caps. It was so clearly another rejection that Tom felt his world totter. "Hold your luff," said Ned sharply. And Tom started guiltily as he saw that he had let the Seraph sag down to leeward. Even though he knew now that it was fruitless, Tom lay on his pallet through all the long first watch, awaiting the hour of midnight, and debating with himself as to whether there was any reason to take the risk and keep true to the assignation he had proposed. Her rejection had seemed categoric, and yet he knew with certainty that she had enjoyed that disturbing moment of intimacy in his father's cabin as much as he had. And that fleeting contact outside Walsh's quarters had confirmed beyond doubt that she was not averse to another adventure. "She ain't the high and mighty lady she pretends," Tom told himself angrily. "Under all those fancy petticoats, she loves it just like Mary or any of the other village girls. I bet a golden guinea to a pinch of dried horse droppings she knows how to play Bury the Mannequin with the best of them." He had removed his pallet to a niche behind one of the cannon, so that neither Guy nor Dorian could lie beside him and keep watch on his comings and goings during the night. The hours of the watch seemed interminable. Once or twice he dozed. But then he would jerk awake, trembling with anticipation or consumed with doubts. When 7 bells in the first watch was struck on the deck above where he lay, he could contain himself no longer, and crept out from under his blanket to make his way stealthily to the head of the companionway, holding his breath in case one of his younger brothers accosted him. Once again he paused outside the tiny cabin in which the 3 girls slept, and placed his ear to the door. He heard nothing, and felt the temptation to tap on the panel to find out if Caroline was lying awake, as he had been. Good sense prevailed, however, and he left the door to creep down onto the lower deck. To his relief, the key to the magazine was where he had left it, along with the tinderbox. He unlocked the door, slipped through it, climbed onto the ready rack to reach the lantern in its gimbals, then took it out into the passage and closed the door carefully so that a spark from the tinderbox would not touch off any loose grains of powder on the magazine floor. He brought the tinderbox down from its hiding place, and squatting on the deck, considered the risk he was taking in striking a flint in the darkness of the ship. It was not so much the danger of explosion that worried him, but that any light might attract attention. His father's cabin was at the top of the companionway, and beside it was that of Mr. Beatty and his wife. They might be sleepless, or one of them might leave the cabin to answer nature's call. The officer of the watch might move through the depths of the hull on his rounds and come to investigate any unusual illumination. Yet Tom knew with absolute certainty that Caroline would have neither the courage nor the knowledge of the layout of the hull to find her way down to the magazine in complete darkness. At least he must give her that much encouragement. He crouched over the tinderbox, shielding it with his body, and struck the steel to the flint. There was a blinding eruption of blue sparks, and the tinder caught. His heart was beating fast as he lifted the mesh screen of the lantern, lit the wick, and cupped it with his hands until it caught fairly. Then he lowered the screen, which dimmed the flame, but protected it from setting off any loose grains of powder. He tucked away both key and tinderbox in their hiding place, then carried the lantern back into the magazine and replaced it in its gimbals. He retreated from the magazine and drew the door to behind him, adjusting the gap so that only the merest glimmer of light showed through. Not enough to attract undue attention, but sufficient to tempt a timid girl to try the ladder of the companionway. Then he crouched beside the door, ready to close it at the first indication of any trouble and blot out the light. He could not hear the ship's bell down here, so close to the bilges, so he lost count of time. "Oh, she's not coming," he told himself, after what seemed to him the passage of several hours. He half rose, but still he could not bring himself to leave. "Just a little longer," he decided, and settled back against the timber bulkhead. He must have dozed, for the first warning he had of her arrival was the perfume of her body, that kitten smell of a young girl, and then he heard the slither of her bare feet on the deck, very close at hand. He sprang up, and she screamed in terror as he rose out of the darkness at her feet. He seized her desperately. "It's me! It's me!" he whispered. "Don't be afraid." She clung to him with surprising strength. "You frightened me." She was shaking wildly, so he held her to his chest and stroked her hair. She had let it down. It was thick and springing under his hands, reaching halfway down her back. "It's all right. You're safe. I'm here to look after you." In the dim light, he saw that she wore a nightdress of pale cotton. It was fastened at her throat with a ribbon and reached down to her ankles. "I should never have come," she whispered, her face pressed to his chest. "Yes. Oh, yes," he told her. "Oh, I've waited so long. I wanted you to come so much." He was amazed at how small she was and how warm her body was against his. He hugged her tighter. "It's all right, Caroline. We're safe here." He ran his hands down her back. The cotton was sheer and flimsy, and she wore no other garment under it. He could feel every swell and hollow of her body. "What if my father..." Her voice was breathless and broken with fear. "No, no, no," he stopped her. "Come with me." He drew her swiftly into the magazine and pushed the door shut behind them. "No one can ever find us in here." He hugged her close and kissed the top of her head. Her hair smelt faintly aromatic. Her shaking eased, and she lifted her face and looked up at him. Her eyes were huge and luminous in the dim light of the screened lantern. "Don't be rough with me," she begged. "Don't hurt me." The very idea appalled him. "Oh, my darling, I could never do that." He found that the words of reassurance came naturally and convincingly to his lips. "I love you. I have loved you since the first moment I laid eyes on your beautiful face." He did not yet realize that he had the gift of eloquence that sets great lovers apart, nor did he know how well it would serve him over the years ahead. "I loved you even when you treated me so coldly." Her waist was so slim that he could almost encircle it with his hands. He pulled her harder against himself, and her belly felt hot against his. "I never wanted to be unkind to you," she told him piteously. "I wanted to be with you, but I couldn't help myself." "You don't have to explain," he said. "I know." And he kissed her face, rained kisses on her forehead and her eyes, until at last he found her mouth. At first, her lips were firmly closed to him. Then slowly they opened like the fleshy petals of some exotic flower, all hot and moist and filled with a nectar that made his senses swim. He wanted to have all of it, to suck out her essence through her mouth. "We're safe here," he reassured her. "No one ever comes down here." He kept whispering reassurances to distract her as he moved her towards the racks of silk powder bags. "Oh, you're so lovely," he eased her backwards. "I've thought about you every waking moment." She relaxed and let herself fall backwards onto the mattress of silk and gunpowder. Her head was thrown back, and he kissed her throat. At the same time, he gently loosed the ribbon that held the top of her nightdress. His instinct warned him to proceed so slowly that she could pretend that it was not happening. He whispered to her, "Your hair is like silk, and it smells of roses." But his fingers were quick and light. One of her breasts popped out of the top of her nightgown, whereupon her whole body stiffened, and she gasped, "Oh, we mustn't do this. You must stop, please." Her breast was very white, and much bigger than he had expected. He made no move to touch it, although it sagged softly against his cheek. He held her tightly and murmured assurances and flattery until slowly the tension left her body and one of her hands groped up to the back of his head. She took a handful of his pigtail, and her grip tightened on it until his eyes watered, but he did not mind the pain. Almost as though she was unaware of what she was doing, she used the handful of his hair to direct him. The warm, soft breast pressed against his face so that for a moment he could not breathe. Then he opened his mouth and sucked in the nipple. It was rubbery and firm in his mouth. Mary had liked him to do this. "Feeding the baby," she'd called it. Caroline made a soft humming sound in the back of her throat and began to rock him softly as though he were an infant. His eyes were closed, and a small half-smile curved his lips as he sucked upon her rhythmically. "Touch me," she murmured, so faintly that he did not understand what she had said. "Touch me," she repeated. "Touch me like you did before." Her gown had rucked up almost to the top of her thighs, and now she moved her knees apart. He reached down and she sighed. "Yes, like that." She began to thrust with her hips, as though she was posting on a trotting pony. It did not take more than a few minutes before her back arched, and he felt every muscle in her small body tense. "It's like drawing a longbow," Tom thought, "when the nocked arrow is ready to loose." Suddenly she shuddered and gave a cry that startled him, then fell back and went limp in his arms like a dead woman. He was alarmed. He looked into her face and saw that it was flushed. Her eyes were closed, and dewy droplets of sweat sparkled on her upper lip. She opened her eyes and stared at him blankly. Then, suddenly, she drew back and struck him a ringing, open-handed blow across the cheek. "I hate you," she whispered fiercely. "You should never have made me come here. You should never have touched me like that. It's all your fault." And she burst into tears. He recoiled in astonishment, but before he could recover, she had leapt to her feet. With a rustle of cloth and small bare feet on the wooden deck, she pushed open the magazine door and fled down the passageway. It was some time before Tom had recovered sufficiently from the shock to stir himself. Still bemused, he doused the lantern, then locked the magazine door behind him carefully. He would have to find an opportunity to return the key to his father's desk, but there was no urgency for that. So far, there had been no indication that its absence from the drawer had been discovered, yet it was too dangerous to keep it on his person, so he returned it to the hiding place above the lintel. When he crept past the door of Caroline's cabin, he found he was trembling with indignation and anger. He felt an almost irresistible urge to drag her from her bunk and vent his feelings upon her. He managed to contain himself and to make his way back to his pallet on the gun deck. Guy was waiting for him, a silent shadow crouching beside the gun carriage. "Where have you been?" he demanded in a whisper. "Nowhere." Tom was taken by surprise, and the fatuous reply was out before he could stop it. I was in the head." "You've been gone since seven bells in the first watch, almost 2 hours," Guy told him grimly. "You must have filled the bucket. It's a wonder there's anything left of you." "Oh, I went on deck," Tom started defensively, then broke off. "Anyway, I don't have to tell you. You're not my keeper." He threw himself on the pallet, curled into a ball and pulled the blanket over his head. "Stupid little vixen," he thought bitterly. "I wouldn't give a fig if she fell overboard and was eaten by the sharks." The Seraph bored on into the southwest, never shortening sail during the starry nights. At noon each day, Tom was on the quarter-deck with the other officers, using his own backstaff, a gift from his father, to observe the noon passage, and to calculate the ship's latitude. His father and Ned Taylor made simultaneous sunshots, then compared their results. On one unforgettable noonday, Tom finished the complex calculation and looked up from his slate. "Well, sir?" his father asked, with an indulgent smile. 22 degrees, 16 minutes, 38 seconds, south latitude," Tom answered uncertainly. "By my reckoning, we should be only a few leagues north of the Tropic of Capricorn." Hal frowned dramatically and looked across at Ned. "A gross error there, Mr. Mate." "Aye, indeed, Captain. He's out by at least 10 seconds. "I make it a 15 seconds of error." Hal's expression softened. "No need to take the cat to him?" "No, not this time." Ned gave one of his rare grins. The difference between the three calculations amounted to no more than a few nautical miles of the ocean's vastness. No man alive could have said which of the three was correct. "Well done, lad," Hal ruffled his hair. "We might make a seaman of you yet." The glow of pleasure those words gave Tom lasted him the rest of that day. As they crossed the Tropic of Capricorn, the weather changed abruptly. They had entered the wet quadrant of the southern Atlantic, and the sky ahead was filled from horizon to heavens with dark, brooding thunderclouds, their immense heads flattened into the shape of the anvils of Vulcan, the blacksmith of the gods. Lightning rippled and glowed in their dark bellies. Thunderclaps beat down like the strokes of the god's hammer. Hal passed the order to shorten sail and made a signal to the yeomen astern of them. "Keep station on me." The sun went down behind the storm clouds and stained them with its blood. Then the rain fell upon the two ships in torrents. Solid sheets of water hammered the wooden decks so hard that the din drowned the men's voices and blotted out their vision. They could see nothing through the roaring curtains of water from one rail to the other. The scuppers could not clear the water from the main deck fast enough, and the helmsmen stood knee-deep. The crew cavorted in this world of sweet water, holding up their faces with mouths wide open, drinking it down until their bellies bulged, stripping off their clothing and washing the salt from their bodies, laughing and splashing each other. Hal made no effort to restrain them. The salt had galled all their bodies, in some cases forming suppurating sea boils in the armpits and crotch. It was a relief to wash the corrosive crystals from their skins. Instead, he ordered the empty water casks filled. The men scooped up bucketfuls of the sweet, pure water, and by nightfall every cask aboard was brimming. The rain never let up all that day or the next day, and on the third day, when the sun rose over the watery wilderness of creamy whitecaps and towering cloud ranges, the yeoman was nowhere in sight. Hal ordered both Tom and Dorian to the masthead, for their young eyes had already proved themselves the sharpest on the ship. Though they stayed aloft most of that day, they could make out no flash of the yeoman's canvas on the disturbed horizon. "Oh, we won't see her again afore we drop anchor off Good Hope," Ned Taylor opined, and secretly Hal agreed with him. There was only the remotest possibility that the two ships would find each other again in this endless expanse of wind-whipped ocean. It did not worry Hal unduly. He had planned with Anderson for just such an eventuality. Their prearranged rendezvous was in Table Bay, and from now onwards each ship would have to make its passage independently of the other. On the 52nd day out of Plymouth, Hal ordered the Seraph put about on the starboard tack. By his calculation, they were less than 1,000 miles off the coast of South America. With the backstaff and the navigational tables, he could confidently place the ship's longitude to within 20 miles. However, the determination of longitude was not an exact science, but more an arcane ritual, based on a study of each day's pegs on the traverse board and a series of guesses and extrapolations of the ship's distance and course made good. Hal knew full well that he could be several hundreds of miles adrift in his dead reckoning. To make a landfall on Good Hope, he would now have to ride the trade winds down until he struck 32 degrees of south latitude, then hold due east until he raised the distinctive tableland that marked the tip of the African continent. This would be the slowest, most wearying leg of the voyage. With the wind almost in his face, he would have to tack every few hours. To avoid missing the Cape to the south and running through into the Indian Ocean beyond, he must lay his course to strike the savage African shore some leagues to the north of Good Hope. There was always the danger of making that landfall in the black of night, or in the dense fog that so often shrouded the southern cape. Many great ships had found a watery graveyard on this treacherous shore. With this threat on his mind, Hal was thankful that when the time came, he would have Tom's and Dorian's sharp young eyes at the masthead. Thinking of his two sons, Hal was pleased with the progress they were making with their Arabic. Guy had dropped out of these lessons on the grounds that there was precious little Arabic spoken in Bombay, but each afternoon Tom and Dorian huddled for an hour with Alf Wilson on the forecastle and chattered away in the language like parakeets. When Hal tested them, he found they could hold their own in a conversation with him. Their growing fluency in the language would stand them in good stead on the Fever Coast. It was a good strategy to speak your enemy's language, Hal thought. Apart from the yeomen, they had not seen another ship since they had left Ushant. But this ocean was not an empty wasteland. There were strange and wonderful sights to intrigue and delight Tom and Dorian as they squatted shoulder to shoulder in the crow's nest high above the deck. One day, out of the great wilderness of water, there came an albatross. Circling the ship on wide pinions, dipping and rising on currents of air, gliding and planing, sometimes so close to the crests of the waves that it seemed to become part of the spume. It kept station with the ship for days on end. Neither of the boys had seen a bird of that size before. At times, it sailed close to where they crouched in their barrel-shaped perch, seeming to use the updraft from the Seraph's mainsail to hold its position, never flapping its wings, only gently fingering the air with the black feathers at the tips. Dorian particularly delighted in the creature, whose wingspan was three or four times that of his arms. Mollymawk, he called it by the sailor's pet name, meaning stupid gull, for its trusting, confiding nature when it settled to earth. Dorian had begged scraps of food from the ship's cook and tossed them to the circling bird. Very soon the albatross had learned to trust and accept him, came winging to his whistle and cry, sailed beside him almost close enough to touch, hanging almost motionless in the air, daintily snapping up the morsels he threw to it. On the third day, while Tom hung on to his belt to prevent him falling, Dorian reached out as far as he could with a piece of fat salt pork in his hand. Mollymawk regarded him with a wise, ancient eye, banked in on his spreading pinions, and took the offering from him with a delicate pinch of his formidable curved beak, which could easily have lopped off one of the boy's fingers. Dorian whistled and clapped his hands in triumph, while all three of the Beatty girls, who had been following his courtship of the bird from the deck below, shrieked with delight. When he came down at the end of the watch, Caroline kissed him in front of the officers of the deck and the on-duty watch. "Girls are so soft," Dorian told Tom, when they were alone on the gun deck, and gave a realistic imitation of puking. Over the next few days, Mollymawk grew tamer and more confiding towards Dorian. "Do you think he loves me, Tom? I shall want to keep him forever as my pet." But on the eighth morning, when they climbed to the masthead, the bird had disappeared. Though Dorian whistled for him all that day, he was gone, and at sunset the child wept bitterly. "What a baby you are," Tom said, and hugged him until he stopped snuffling. On the morning after Mollymawk disappeared, Tom took his usual seat on the bench against the bulkhead in Master Walsh's cabin. When the three girls arrived, late as usual, for the day's lessons, he resisted the temptation to look in Caroline's direction. He was still simmering with indignation at the way she had treated him. Sarah Beatty, who still hero-worshipped him and was forever plying him with small gifts, had today made him a paper rose as a bookmark, which she presented to him in front of everyone else in the cabin. Tom flushed with humiliation as he mumbled a churlish thanks, while behind Sarah's back Dorian held an imaginary baby in his arms and rocked it. Tom kicked his shin and reached for his books and slate, which he kept in the locker under the bench. When he glanced at the slate, he saw that someone had rubbed out the algebra equation with which he had been struggling the previous day. He was about to accuse Dorian of the crime, when he realised that the culprit had replaced his convoluted chalk scribbling with a simple line in a flowery script. "Tonight, at the same time." Tom stared at it. The handwriting was unmistakable. Dorian and the younger girl still had a childlike, uneven scrawl, and Guy's hand was stolid and lacking in any art. Although he still hated Caroline to the depths of his soul, He would have recognised her handwriting anywhere and at any time. Suddenly he became aware that Guy was craning across, trying to read the slate over his shoulder. Tom tilted it to hide it from him, and with one thumb smeared the chalk letters until they were indecipherable. He could not stop himself glancing across to where Caroline sat. She seemed oblivious, as always, to his presence, absorbed in the book of poetry that Master Walsh had lent her. But she must have sensed his eyes on her, because the one ear that Tom could see peeping out from under her bonnet in a tangle of curls slowly turned a deeper shade of pink. It was such a striking phenomenon that Tom forgot he hated her and stared at it in fascination. "Thomas, have you completed the problem I set for you yesterday?" Walsh roused him, and he started guiltily. "Yes, I mean, no, I mean almost." For the rest of that day, Tom was in a stew of emotion. At one minute he determined to scorn the tryst she had proposed and laugh in her face the next morning. He even uttered the scornful laugh aloud, and every person in the cabin stopped what he or she was doing and looked up at him expectantly. "Is there some gem of wit or erudition that you wish to share with us, Thomas?" Walsh asked sarcastically. "No, sir, I was just thinking." "Ah, I thought I heard the wheels rumbling. But let us not interrupt such a rare occurrence. Please continue, sir." All that day his feelings for Caroline oscillated from adoration to angry loathing. Later, when he sat high in the crow's nest, he noticed nothing except that the waters seemed as violet blue as her eyes. Dorian had to point out to him the pale feather on the horizon where a whale spouted, and even then he viewed it without interest. When he stood beside his father and made the noonday sight through the aperture of his backstaff, he remembered the feel of a soft white bosom pressed to his face, and his thoughts drifted away. When his father took the navigation slate from his hands and read his working, he turned to Ned Tyler. "Well, congratulations, Mr. Tyler. During the night you must have sailed us back into the Northern Hemisphere. Send a good man to a masthead. We should be making a landfall on the east coast of America at any minute now." Tom had no appetite for his dinner, and gave his cut of salt beef to Dorian, whose appetite was legendary, and who accepted it with alacrity, then wolfed it down before Tom could change his mind. Then, when the gun-deck lanterns were trimmed down for the night, Tom lay unsleeping in his corner behind the gun carriage, and went over his preparations again and again in his mind. The magazine key and tinderbox were still where he had left them, in their niche above the door. He had been waiting for an opportunity to return the key to his father's desk, but none had presented itself. Now he was deeply grateful for that. He had decided by now that he loved Caroline beyond anything in the world, and that he would not hesitate to lay down his life for her. At 7 bells in the first watch, he crept from his pallet and paused to see if anyone had seen him rise. His two brothers were smaller, dark shapes beyond Aboli's bulk, stretched out on the deck in the dim light of the shuttered battle lanterns. Stepping over the huddled, snoring bodies of the rest of the crew, he made his way unchallenged to the companionway. Once again the lamp was burning in his father's cabin, and Tom wondered what always kept him awake until after midnight. He moved softly past and could not prevent himself from stopping again beside the girl's cabin. He thought he heard soft breathing beyond the bulkhead, and once the sound of one of the younger girls talking in her sleep, a few gabbled words. He passed on and took the key from its hiding place, and went into the magazine to fetch out the lantern, light it, and replace it in its gimbals. By this time he was so overwrought that he jumped at every strange noise in the running ship, the scuffle of a rat in the bilges, or the rattle and knock of a loose piece of rope or rigging. He crouched beside the magazine door and watched the foot of the ladder. This time he did not doze, so he saw her bare white feet the moment they came hesitantly into view. He whistled softly to reassure her. She stooped and looked at him. Then she came down the last few steps of the ladder with a rush. He ran to meet her, and she came into his arms and clung to him. "I wanted to say how sorry I was that I struck you," she whispered. "I have hated myself for that every day since then." He could not trust himself to speak, and when he remained silent, she lifted her face to him. It was merely a pale luminescence in the poor light, but he stooped to kiss her, searching for her mouth. She moved towards him at the same moment, and his first kiss was on her eyebrow, the next on the tip of her nose, and then their mouths came together. She was the first to pull back. "Not here," she whispered. "Somebody may come." She followed him willingly as he took her hand and drew her through the door into the magazine. Without hesitation, she went directly to the rack of powder bags and drew him down beside her. Her mouth was open to his next kiss, and he felt the tip of her tongue fluttering on his lips like a moth at the candle flame. He sucked it in. Still mouth to mouth, she tugged at the drawstring that closed the top of his shirt, and when she had it loose, she thrust one small, cool hand down into the opening and caressed his chest. "You're hairy," she sounded surprised. "I want to see." She lifted the front of his shirt. "Silky. It feels so soft." She pressed her face to his chest. Her breath was warm and tickling. It excited him in a way he had not known before. A sense of urgency came over him, as though she might be whisked away from him at any moment. He tried to loosen the ribbon that closed her nightdress, but his fingers were clumsy and unskilled. "Here," she pushed away his hands. "Let me do that." He was vaguely aware that she was behaving differently from their last meeting here in the magazine. She was assertive and sure of herself. She was acting more like Mary or one of the other girls he had been with at High Weald. All at once he was convinced that his intuition had been accurate. She had done this before. She knew as much as he, or perhaps more, and the knowledge goaded him on. There was no longer cause for him to hold himself back. She knelt up, lifted the nightgown over her head in one movement, and dropped it to the deck. She was mother naked now, but all he saw were her breasts, big, round, and white, seeming to glow like two great pearls, hanging above him in the gloom. He reached for them, filling both his hands with their soft abundance. "Not so hard, don't be so rough," she warned him. For a while she let him do what he wanted, and then she whispered, "Touch me. Touch me there, like before." He did as she asked, and she closed her eyes and lay quietly. Gently he moved over her, careful not to alarm her. He eased his breeches down to his knees. Suddenly she tried to sit up. "Why did you stop?" She looked down. "What are you doing? No, stop that!" She tried to wriggle out from under him, but he was much heavier and stronger than she was, and she could not move him. "I won't hurt you," he promised. She pushed ineffectually at his shoulders, but slowly she gave up. She stopped struggling and relaxed under the insistence of his touch. The rigidity went out of her body. She closed her eyes and started to make that soft humming sound in the back of her throat. Suddenly her whole body convulsed and she gave a soft cry. "What are you doing? Please, no, oh, Tom, what are you doing?" She struggled again, but he held her very tightly, and after a while she lay quietly in his arms. Then both of them started to move in unison, in the natural rhythms as old as man himself. Long afterwards they lay together with the sweat cooling on their bodies, their breathing steadying until they could speak again. "It's late. Agnes and Sarah will be awake soon. I must go," Caroline whispered, and reached for her nightgown. "Will you come again?" he asked her. "Perhaps." She drew the gown over her head and tied the ribbon at her throat. "Tomorrow night," he insisted. "Perhaps," she repeated. Slipped off the rack and went to the magazine door. She listened there, then peeped through the crack. She pushed open the door just wide enough to slip through and was gone. Gradually, the Seraph sailed out of the tropical latitudes and on into the south. The days cooled, and after the stifling heat they had endured, the wind came sweet and fresh out of the southeast. This temperate ocean swarmed with life, clouded green with krill and plankton. From the masthead they could make out shadowy shoals of tuna, endless streams of huge fish effortlessly overtaking the ship on their mysterious perambulations through the green ocean. At last the noonday sunshot proved that the ship had made her southing, and at 32 degrees south latitude Howell brought the bows around for the final run down to Good Hope. It was a relief to him that the end of this leg of the voyage was approaching, and that they must soon be making their landfall. Only the previous day Dr. Reynolds had reported to him the first cases of scurvy among the crew. This mysterious affliction was the curse of every captain undertaking a long passage. Once a ship had been at sea for 6 weeks, the foul miasma that bred the disease might overtake the crew and strike them down without reason or warning. The two sick men were merely the first of many, Hal knew. They had shown the surgeon their swollen, bleeding gums and the first dark bruises on their bellies, where blood was weeping under the skin. No man could account for this pestilence, or for the miraculous manner in which it vanished and its victims were cured once the ship reached port. "Let it be soon, Lord," Hal prayed, and looked to the empty eastern horizon. Now, as they approached the land, pods of dolphin joined them, riding the bow wave, dodging back and forth under the hull, rising again on the far side and curving their glistening black backs through the surface, finning high with their flat tails beating, eyeing the men in the rigging with a bright eye and fixed grin. This was the ocean of the great whales. On some days they saw their spouts blowing white on the wind, wherever they looked from the masthead. The mountainous creatures wallowed and cavorted on the surface. Some were longer than the Seraph's hull, and they passed so close that the boys could see the barnacles and growths of sea life that encrusted their bodies, as though they were reefs of rock, not living creatures. "There is 20 tons of oil in each fish," Big Daniel remarked to Tom, as they leaned together on the bowsprit and watched a leviathan rise from the depths a cable's length ahead and lift its massive, bifurcated tail to the skies. "That tail is as wide across as our mizzen yard," Tom marvelled. "Oh, they do say they are the biggest creatures in creation," Daniel nodded. "At 10 pounds the ton of his oil we might do better at chasing whales than pirates." "But how could you ever kill a thing that big?" Tom wondered. "It would be like trying to kill a mountain." "Oh, dangerous work it is, but there's them that do it. The Dutch are great whale hunters." "I should like to try," said Tom. "I should like to be a great hunter." Big Daniel pointed down the bowsprit as it rose and fell across the horizon. "There is much to hunt where we're going, lad. It's a land swarming with wild creatures. There are elephants with ivory tusks longer than you are. You may get your wish." Tom's excitement was heightened with each day's run. After they had made the sunshot, he went to the stern cabin with his father to watch him mark the ship's position. The line on the chart crept ever closer to the great landmass, shaped like the head of a horse. His days were so filled with excitement and frantic activity that he should have been exhausted by nightfall. Most evenings he managed a few hours' sleep before midnight, but then he woke eagerly at the end of the first watch and crept from his pallet. He no longer had to beg and cajole. Caroline came to the magazine every night of her own accord. Tom found that he had aroused a wildcat. She was no longer hesitant or modest, but matched him in the urgency of her passion, giving vent to her emotions with voice and savage excess. Tom often carried away with him the evidence of their meetings, his back scratched by her long fingernails, his lips bitten and bruised. However, he had become careless in his haste to keep their assignation each night, and had a number of close calls. Once when he was passing Mr. Beatty's cabin, the door opened suddenly and Mrs. Beatty stepped out. Tom just had time to pull his cap over his eyes as he slouched past and disguised his voice. "Seven bells in the first watch and all's well," he croaked hoarsely. He was tall as any man aboard now, and the passageway was dimly lit. "Thank you, my good man." Mrs. Beatty was so flustered at being caught in her nightclothes that she ducked back into the cabin as if she were the guilty one. On more than one night he felt he was being followed as he crept down from the gun deck. Once he was certain he had heard footsteps coming down the companionway behind him, but when he doubled back, nobody was there. On another occasion he was leaving the lower deck in the small hours, at the end of the middle watch, when there came the clump of sea boots down the ladder from the quarter-deck. He only just had time to duck back when Ned Tyler came down the passage towards his father's cabin. From the shadows he watched him knock at the door and heard his father's voice from within. "What is it?" "Ned Tyler, Captain. Wind's freshening. She could carry away a spar if we drive her on. Permission to take in the staysails and reef the main course. I'll be on deck right away, Ned, Tom's father replied. A minute later, he burst out of his cabin, shrugging on his pea jacket, and passed a few feet from where Tom lay as he ran up the companionway to the deck. Tom reached his pallet on the gun deck just as the bosun's whistle shrilled and Big Daniel's voice boomed out in the darkness, "All hands to shorten sail!" Tom had to pretend to rub the sleep out of his eyes and join the rush of men up into the blustery night. It was in his nature not to be alarmed or cowed by these narrow escapes, and perversely he became emboldened by them. Nowadays there was a strut to his stride like that of a young rooster, which made Aberley grin and shake his head. "Hey, this is the son of a man." One morning, when the ship had been put about on the port tack, and her motion had eased to a long rise and thrust through the green Atlantic rollers, Tom was among the topmastmen coming down from working the canvas. Suddenly, for no reason other than high spirits and cockiness, he stood up to his full height on the yard and danced a high hornpipe. Every person on deck froze with horror as they watched Tom's suicidal antics. 40 feet above the deck, Tom performed 2 full passes, 3 to the measure, on bare tiptoe, one hand on his hip and the other over his head. Then he jumped on the shrouds and slid down to the deck below. He had had enough sense to make certain that his father was in his cabin at the time, but before the day was out, Howell had heard about the escapade and sent for Tom. "Why did you do such a stupid, irresponsible thing?" he demanded. "Because John Tudwell told me I wouldn't dare," Tom explained, as though this was the best reason in the world. Which perhaps it was, Howell thought, as he studied his son's face. To his astonishment, he realized that he was looking at a man, not a boy. In the few short months of the voyage, Tom had toughened and matured beyond all recognition. His body was work-hardened, his shoulders had filled out from the constant exertion of climbing in the rigging and handling canvas and sheets in a heavy blow. His arms were muscled from the hours of sword drill with Aboli each day, and he balanced like a cat to the ship's pitch in the southern rollers. But there was something else he could not quite put his finger on. He knew that Tom had always been the precocious one among all his sons. And though he had tried to control his wilder extravagances, he had never wanted to fetter this bold, adventurous spirit. Secretly, Howell had admired the boy's courage and was proud of his headstrong ways, but now he was aware that something had happened that he had missed. This was a man, full grown, who faced him with level gaze. "Well," Howell said at last, "you've shown John Tudwell he was wrong, haven't you? So there's no need to do the high hornpipe again." "No, father," Tom agreed readily. "That is, not until somebody else tells me I lack the guts for it." His grin was so infectious that Howell felt his own mouth pulled out of shape. "Ah, get away with you." He gave Tom a shove towards the cabin door. "There's no reasoning with a barbarian." Guy sat at his accustomed place on the bench beside Caroline in Master Walsh's cabin. His face was pale, and he spoke little during the course of the morning, answering any question from the schoolmaster in a terse monosyllable. He kept his eyes on his book, not looking at either Tom or Caroline, even when they were reciting the texts that Walsh had asked for. At last, Caroline became aware of his strange behaviour. "Are you out of sorts, Guy? Are you feeling seasick again?" she whispered. Guy could not bring himself to look into her face. "I am perfectly well," he told her. "You need not worry about me," and added silently, "ever again." Guy had conjured up a fantasy world over the past weeks, since he had signed his indenture papers and his employment in the company factory at Bombay had been secured. With his family connections and under the patronage of Mr. Beatty, he had foreseen his rapid advancement in the service of the company. The Beatty family would have become his own, and Caroline would have been there beside him. He imagined sharing her company every day in the tropical paradise of Bombay. They would ride together through palm groves. In the evenings there would be music recitals, Guy playing and Caroline singing, and poetry readings, picnics with the family. He would walk hand in hand with her along white beaches, exchange with her pure, chaste kisses. In a few short years, he would be 20 years old, high in the company service, and well able to afford to marry. Now all these dreams were shattered. When he tried to think of the vile things he had uncovered, his mind shied away from them like a skittish horse. His hands shook, and he felt the blood fuming in his brain. He could not bear another minute in the confines of the tiny cabin with the two people he hated more than he had ever believed himself capable. He stood up abruptly. Master Walsh, please excuse me, I am feeling faint. I need to take a turn on the deck, the fresh air. Without waiting for permission, he stumbled to the door and fled up the ladder. He hurried to the bows and clung to a halyard, letting the wind blow in his face. His misery was bottomless, and the rest of his life stretched ahead like an endless desert plain. "I want to die," he said aloud, and peered over the ship's side. The water was green and beautiful. It would be so peaceful down there. He stepped down onto the chains and balanced there, hanging on with one hand on the shrouds. "It'll be so easy," he told himself. "So quick and easy," he began to lean outwards over the rushing, curling bow wave. A powerful grip closed on his free wrist, and he almost lost his balance. "There's nothing that you have lost down there, Mbili," Arbeli's voice rumbled. "You never were a swimmer." "Leave me," Guy said bitterly. "Why do you always interfere, Abuli? I just want to die."
"You will have your wish. That is the only thing certain in this life," Abuli assured him. "But not today, Mbili."
The name he had called Guy from the day of his birth meant number two in the language of the forests. Gently he exerted pressure on his arm. Guy tried vainly to resist that great strength.
"Leave me, Abuli, please."
"The men are looking at you," Abuli told him softly.
Guy looked round and saw that some of the watch on deck had stopped their talk and were watching this little pantomime curiously.
"Do not shame your father and me with this stupidity."
Guy capitulated and hopped down clumsily onto the deck. Abuli released his wrist.
"Let us talk," he suggested.
"I do not want to talk, to you or to anybody."
"Then we will be silent together," Abuli agreed, and led him to the lee rail.
They squatted together there, shielded from the wind and from the eyes of the watch. Abuli was calm and silent, like a mountain, a reassuring presence. He did not look at Guy or touch him, but he was there. The long minutes drew out, then Guy blurted out wildly,
"I love her so, Abuli. It's like fangs gnawing at my belly."
So, Abuli thought sadly, he has found out the truth. Klebi is not one to hide his tracks. He is after this filly like a young stallion that has kicked down the fence. It is a wonder that Mbili took so long to discover it.
"Yes, I know Mbili," he said. "I have also loved."
"What am I to do?"
Guy demanded miserably.
"No matter how much it hurts, it will never kill you. And one day, sooner than you will believe possible, you will have forgotten the pain."
"I will never forget it," said Guy with deep conviction.
"And I will never forget my love for her."
Hal Courtney heard the ship's bells sound the beginning of the middle watch.
"Midnight," he murmured. He pressed both fists into the small of his back. He had sat at his desk for many hours. He felt stiff and his eyes smarted. He stood up and trimmed the wick of the lamp, adjusting it to light the documents on his desktop, then seated himself again in the heavy oak chair and applied himself once more to his work. The builder's drawings of Seraph were spread before him. He studied the plan of her gun decks for a while, then set it on one side, pulled towards him the drawing of the side elevation and compared the two.
"We have to conceal the guns to give her the look of an unarmed trader," he murmured. "It will mean stripping the lids off the gun ports of the lower deck." He broke off and frowned as he heard a soft scratching at the door of his cabin. "Who is it?" he demanded. The weather was fair and the wind light and steady. He had not expected to be interrupted. There was no answer to his challenge, and after a moment he grunted. It must have been a rat, or his imagination. He turned his attention back to the drawings. The scratching at the door came again. This time he pushed back his chair irritably and stood up. Stooping under the beams, he strode to the door and pulled it open. A slight figure stood diffidently before him. It took Hal a moment to recognise his own son. "Guy?" He peered closely at him. "What are you doing here at this time of night? Come in, boy." Guy stepped into the cabin and pulled the door to behind him. He plucked his cap from his head. His face was pale and his expression nervous.
"Father, I had to tell you," he stammered, twisting the cap in his hands.
"Well, what is it, lad? Speak up," Hal encouraged him.
"There's somebody in the powder magazine in the hold," Guy blurted out. "The door is open and there is a light."
"What?" Hal's voice was sharp with alarm.
"In the magazine? A light?"
A host of dire misgivings crowded his mind.
"Yes, sir."
Hal whirled and crossed to his desk. He jerked open the top drawer and lifted out the wooden case of pistols. He opened it and took out one of the double-barreled weapons, swiftly checked the flint and the priming, then thrust it into his belt. Then he checked the second of the pair and hefted it in his right hand. "Well, we'll see about this," he muttered grimly, and lifted the lamp out of its gimbals. "Come with me, Guy, but softly. We don't want to warn the rascals, whoever they are." He eased open the cabin door, and Guy followed him out into the passageway. "Close it quietly," Hal warned, and went to the head of the companionway. He peered down into the lower deck, but saw no glimmer of light. He turned his head to Guy. "Are you sure?"
"Yes, father."
Stepping lightly, Hal started down the ladder, stopping on each tread to listen and look. He reached the bottom and paused again. Only then did he see the faint nimbus of light around the edges of the magazine door.
"Yes," he whispered, and cocked both hammers of the pistol in his hand. "Yes, well, now we'll see what they're up to."
He started towards the magazine, carrying the lamp behind his back to shield the flame. Guy was close behind him. Hal reached the door and placed his ear to the thick oak panel. Faintly above the other noises of the ship, he heard sounds that puzzled him. Soft cries and moans, a rustling and thudding he could not place. He tried the lock, and the handle turned readily enough in his hand. He put his shoulder against the door and gradually applied his weight. The jamb scraped softly, and then the door swung open. He stood in the entrance and lifted his lantern high above his head. For a while he was deprived of the power of further movement. The scene before him was so far from his expectations that he could not make sense of what he was seeing. The screened lamp in its gimbals on the bulkhead above the ready racks added its light to the rays of his own lantern. Clothing was jumbled on the deck at Hal's feet, and human bodies sprawled over the silk powder bags before him. It took a moment for him to realize they were naked. Pale skin gleamed bright in the lamplight, and he stared in disbelief. A woman's curls, tangled limbs, red mouth open wide, small feet that kicked spasmodically towards the deck beams above, slim hands that clutched and twisted in a man's hair, the man's head buried between her pearly thighs, her back and buttocks thumping against the mattress of powder bags as she writhed in transport. The pair seemed oblivious to anything but each other. Even the lantern turned full upon them had not alarmed them, for the girl's eyes were tightly closed, and her features so contorted with passion that she seemed a stranger to Hal. He stood there transfixed, and only roused himself when Guy tried to push his way into the magazine. He moved to block his entrance and screen the scene from him. "Get back, Guy," he said, and his voice penetrated the curtains of passion that shrouded the pair on the rack. The woman's eyes flew open, then slowly expanded like the petals of a violet bloom as she stared at Hal in horror and disbelief. Her mouth twisted in a silent scream of despair, and she struggled up on one elbow, her breasts swinging round and white in the lamplight. With both hands she tore at the dark hair of the head lodged between her thighs, but could not budge it. "Tom!" Hal found his voice at last. He saw the muscles in the boy's broad white back convulse with shock, as though a dagger had been plunged into them. Then Tom lifted his face and stared at his father. It seemed an eternity that all three were frozen like that. Tom's face was suffused with blood, as though he had run a race or wrestled a heavy bout. His gaze was as unfocused and vague as that of a drunkard.
"In the name of God, girl, cover yourself," Hal grated.
He
His own shame flared up as he found it took a huge effort on his part to tear his eyes from her spread-eagled body. At his words, she kicked Tom away with both feet and tumbled from the rack onto the deck. She snatched up her discarded nightdress and held it to her chest with both hands, trying to cover her nudity, crouching there on her knees like a wild animal in a trap. Howell turned his back on her and found Guy pressing close behind him, craning to see what was happening in the magazine. Howell shoved him roughly out into the passageway. "Get you back to your bed," he snarled. "This is not your business." Guy backed away at the venom in his father's voice. "Tell no one of what you have seen here tonight, for if you do, I will flay the skin from your back." Guy backed slowly and reluctantly up the ladder, and Howell turned into the magazine. Caroline had pulled the gown over her head, and now it covered her to her ankles. She stood before him, hanging her head. The thick curls and ringlets fell forward and covered her face. She looked like a little girl, young and innocent. "Which she has, as the devil is witness, proven she is not," Howell thought grimly, and looked at his son, who was hopping on one leg, trying to get his other into his breeches. There was no longer any trace of his usual cockiness or braggadocio. He hauled his breeches up to his waist and buckled his belt, then stood abjectly beside the girl, neither of them able to meet Howell's stern gaze. "Mistress Caroline," Howell ordered, "you will go this very instant to your cabin." "Yes, Captain," she whispered. "I can only say that I am disgusted by your behaviour. I never expected anything of the like from a lady of your breeding." He felt vaguely ridiculous as he said it, as though the lower classes are the only ones who should make the beast with two backs, he mocked himself silently, and searched for some pronouncement less fatuous. "What will your father make of it when I tell him?" he demanded. She looked up at him with real terror dissolving her prettiness. "You won't tell him." Suddenly, embarrassingly, she fell at his feet and hugged his knees. "Please don't tell him, Captain. I will do anything. Only please don't tell him." "Get up, girl!" Howell lifted her to her feet, his anger fading. It took an effort to fan the flames. "Go to your cabin and stay there until I send for you." "You won't tell my father!" she pleaded. Tears were streaming down her face now. "I make you no promise on that," he said. "You richly deserve the horsewhip that I know he will take to you." He led her out and pushed her towards her cabin. She fled up the ladder, and he heard her door open and close softly. Howell turned back to Tom and tried to glare at him, but felt the flames of indignation subside. Despite himself, he journeyed back over the years to another boy and girl in a dark ship's cabin in these southern seas. He had been Tom's age, and the Dutch girl 5 years his senior, when she had carried him over the threshold into manhood. She had possessed golden hair and the face of an innocent angel, but the body of a wanton and the nature of a she-devil. He blinked as he brought his mind back from the 25 years ago, and found Tom still standing contritely before him. "Miss Beatty is a passenger on the ship, and therefore in my care," he said. "You have shamed yourself and me."
"I am sorry, Father."
"I don't think you are." Howell studied his face and saw him struggling with the truth.
"I mean, I'm sorry I shamed you,"
Tom qualified himself.
"But as nobody but us knows of it, then your shame need never be made public, sir."
Howell had to stop himself gasping at his son's effrontery. But then he followed the quick-witted logic.
"You are a barbarian, sir," he said gravely, and thought, "as I was, as every red-blooded young buck is at your age."
"I shall try to improve myself," Tom promised.
Howell stared at him. He would never have dared address his own father in that fashion. He had been terrified of his father. This boy was not terrified of him. Respected and admired him, perhaps, loved him, certainly, but felt no terror when they stood face to face like this.
"Have I failed in my duty? Should I have made him fear me?" he wondered.
"No, I am glad of it. I have made him a man."
"Father, I will readily accept whatever punishment you see fit to lay on me. But if you tell Caroline's family of this, you will bring disgrace upon her and ruin her life."
Tom spoke up with barely a tremor in his voice. "She does not deserve that from us."
"I agree with you," Howell admitted reluctantly. "Do I have your undertaking never to try to be alone with the girl again while she is on the ship?"
"I promise you that."
Tom raised his right hand.
"I swear it to you." "Then we shall not speak of it again, and I will say nothing to Mr. Beatty."
"Thank you, sir."
Hal felt rewarded when he saw the expression in his son's eyes, then had to cough to clear the constriction in his throat. He cast around swiftly for some way to avoid having to pursue the subject.
"How did you get into the magazine?"
"I borrowed the key from your desk," Tom answered straight.
"Borrowed?"
Hal demanded.
"Yes, sir. I would have returned it when I was finished with it."
"You have no further need of it now, that I assure you," Hal told him grimly. Tom went obediently to the doorway, reached up to the niche and brought down the key.
"Lock the door,"
Hal ordered.
"And when Tom had done so, give it to me."
Tom placed it in his hand.
"I think that is more than enough for one night," Hal said. "Go to your mattress now."
"Good night, Father. And I am truly sorry that I have caused you distress."
Hal watched him disappear up the ladder, then grinned ruefully. "Perhaps I could have conducted that little skirmish with more aplomb," he thought. "But the devil tell me how." Guy waited expectantly for the uproar that must follow his disclosure of the sinful pair. He expected Caroline to be castigated by her father, perhaps beaten like a scullery maid caught stealing, reviled by her mother and sisters, become such an outcast that she would have only him to turn to for comfort. In his imaginings, she came to him and begged his forgiveness for having betrayed the pure, honest love he held for her. She threw herself on his mercy and promised that if he forgave her, she would try for the rest of her life to make amends to him. The thought of it warmed him and made up for the terrible suffering he had endured since the night when he had first followed Tom down to the lower deck and discovered the filth in which he was engaged. Then he hoped that his father might haul Tom before the ship's company and order him placed on the triangle and publicly flogged, though in his heart he knew that this was too much to hope for. But at least he might force Tom to apologise to Mr. and Mrs. Beatty and forbid him ever again to speak to Caroline or any other member of the family. Tom would become the ship's pariah. Perhaps his father might have him removed from the Seraph when they reached Good Hope, even sent back to England in disgrace to suffer the tyranny of Black Billy at High Weald. He waited eagerly for some or all of these things to happen. His chagrin deepened as each day passed, as though nothing earth-shattering had occurred, as if his emotional turmoil and suffering were of no consequence. It was true that for several days thereafter, Caroline was quiet and withdrawn, starting whenever she heard footsteps outside the cabin where they laboured together over their books, looking terrified when she heard her father's voice booming out from the deck above, never glancing in Tom's direction but keeping her eyes on her books. Guy noticed with some small satisfaction that if Tom came on deck when she was there with her mother and sisters, she immediately made some excuse and went down to her own little cabin, staying there alone for hours. This lasted less than a week. Then she rapidly recovered her old poise and appealing manners. The roses bloomed once more in her cheeks. She laughed and joked with Master Welsh and sang as prettily in the duets with Dorian during the music recitals. For some time, Guy refused to take part in these evenings, pleading ill health. And he lay miserably on his pallet on the gun deck, listening to the faint sounds of music and laughter from the deck below. In the end, he allowed Master Welsh to persuade him to return with his Saturn, although his expression and mien, while he played, were heroically tragic. As for Tom, he showed precious little remorse for his treachery and deceit. True, for a while he made no effort to talk to Caroline or even catch her attention, but this was nothing new. It was one of his perfidious ways. Then, during one of their lessons, Guy intercepted an exchange between the pair. Caroline dropped her chalk to the deck, and before Guy could retrieve it for her, she had stooped and groped for it under the table. The ship rolled, and the chalk skittered across the deck towards Tom, who scooped it up, and with a mock gallant bow, handed it to her, at the same time taking the opportunity to peer down her décolletage. Caroline, with dancing eyes, turned so that Master Welsh could not see her face, and stuck out her tongue at Tom. It was not a childlike gesture, but suggestive and inviting, fraught with sexual undertones. Tom acknowledged it with a leer and a wink that made Caroline blush prettily, and struck Guy like a blow in the face from a clenched fist. He brooded on it for the rest of that day, but could think of only one way in which to try to show Caroline how much she had hurt him, how she had destroyed his trust in her and shattered his life. He moved his seat in the classroom. The following day, without permission or explanation, he left the bench beside Caroline and went to the low, uncomfortable stool in the corner furthest from her. This tactic had unforeseen and undesirable results. Master Walsh took in the rearrangement of his classroom at a glance, then looked across at Guy.
"Why have you moved?"
"I'm more comfortable here," Guy replied sullenly, without looking at him or Caroline.
"In that case," Walsh looked across at Tom, "I think it would be better if Tom moved over beside Mistress Caroline. There I can better keep him under my eye."
Tom needed no second invitation. And for the rest of the morning, Guy was forced to witness the play between the two. While frowning at his slate, Tom surreptitiously moved one of his great clodhoppers under the table to touch her elegant satin slipper. Caroline smiled secretly to herself, as though at something she had just read, but made no move to withdraw her foot. Then, a little later, Tom wrote something on his slate, and when Walsh was busy marking Dorian's arithmetic, held it so that she could read it. Caroline glanced at what he had written and then flushed and tossed her curls as if in annoyance, but her eyes danced. Then she scribbled on her own slate and let Tom read it. He grinned like the lout Guy knew he was. Guy was consumed with jealous rage, but he was helpless. He was forced to watch them flirting, teasing each other, and his hatred boiled up until he felt he could no longer contain it. He was haunted by the images of the terrible things he had witnessed in the magazine. His father's bulk had screened from him most of the horror of that night, and the light had been poor, but the gleam of her white skin and the tantalizing roundness and soft shapes of her body flashed before him again until he hated her, but at the same time ached with longing for her. Then he saw again his brother, and the unspeakable act he was committing, degrading that perfect, pure and lovely form. He was like a pig, like a filthy boar, guzzling and snorting at the trough. He tried to find the most extreme words in his lexicon to portray the depth of his revulsion, but they fell short of his true feelings. "I hate him," he thought fiercely, "and then I will kill him." He felt a stab of guilt at the thought, but almost immediately that evaporated, to be replaced by a savage joy. "Yes, I will kill him." It was the only way open to him. Guy watched for his opportunity. At noon the next day he was strolling with Mr. Beatty up and down the forecastle, while the officers of the watch, including his father and Tom, made the sunshot with their backstaffs. Mr. Beatty was explaining to him in detail how the affairs of the company were administered in the Orient. "We have two factories on the Carnatic coast. Do you know where that is, Courtney?"
"Yes, sir."
Guy had studied the huge pile of books and documents that Mr. Beatty had given him to read. "The Carnatic is that stretch of country in southeast India between Eastern Ghats and the Coromandel coast. It is one of the richest trading areas in the Orient," he recited dutifully. Mr. Beatty nodded. "I see you are taking your duties seriously," he said. Guy tried to keep his mind on the conversation, but his attention kept wandering to the group on the quarterdeck. He saw them confer over the traverse board at the helm. Then Tom scribbled on his slate and showed the result to his father.
"Well done, lad. I'll mark it so on the chart."
His father's voice carried even against the wind. The commendation irked Guy and increased his determination to carry through his plan. His father took a last turn up and down the deck, darting sharp glances at the set of the sails and the course in the binnacle. He was an imposing figure, tall and broad-shouldered, with handsome, well-formed features and thick, dark hair knotted at the back of his head. Guy felt daunted at the prospect of having to confront him. At last, Hal handed over the deck to the officer of the watch,
and disappeared down the companionway to his own quarters.
"Sir," Guy turned to Mr. Beatty, "will you please excuse me? There is something of the utmost importance I must discuss with my father."
"Of course," Mr. Beatty waved him away. "I shall be here when you return. We shall continue our conversation then. I find it most diverting." Guy knocked at the door of the stern cabin and opened it when his father's voice called from within, "Enter!" He looked up from the ship's log in which he was recording the noon position, with the plume of his pen poised over the page. "Yes, lad, what is it?"
Guy took a deep breath.
"I want to challenge Tom to a duel."
Carefully, Hal replaced the goose quill in the inkwell and rubbed his chin reflectively before he looked up again.
"What is this about?" "You know, Father, you were there. It is so disgusting that I cannot bring myself to discuss it. But Tom has given deep offence to Mistress Caroline."
"Ah," Hal sighed. "So that's it." As he studied Guy's taut features silently, he thought, if what the little trollop was doing on her back in the powder magazine was taking offence, then she has a remarkable way of demonstrating it. At last he said,
"And what is she to you?" "I love her, Father," said Guy, with a simple, touching dignity that took Hal unawares.
He stopped the smile that was already rising to his lips.
"And is the lady aware of your feelings?" "I know not," Guy admitted.
"You have not declared them to her? You are not betrothed? You have not spoken to Mr. Beatty for his daughter's hand?"
Guy faltered. "No, Father, not yet. I am but 17, and..."
"Then I fear that you might have left it a trifle late," Hal spoke not unkindly. He remembered the agony of young love full well, which, in the circumstances, is probably fortunate.
"I do not follow your meaning, sir."
Guy drew himself up stiffly. "Now I have to qualify myself to the little prig," Hal thought, with secret amusement.
"Simply put, now that you are painfully aware of the predilections, shall we say, of Mistress Beatty, you may wish to review your affection for her. Is she worthy of such noble love as that which you bear her? Has your brother not done you a service by bringing her true nature, even as forcefully as he did, to your attention?"
He was going to add, "It seems clear that Mistress Caroline is a little strumpet." But he bit back the words, thinking, "I do not want to be challenged to a duel by my own son."
"Tom forced her to it," Guy answered with grim determination. "That is why I must challenge him."
"Did he drag her down to the magazine against her will?"
"Perhaps not, but he enticed her. He seduced her." "If you call Tom out, will not the entire ship's company become aware of what has transpired between Tom and her? Do you want her father to learn of her little indiscretion? Do you want her to suffer the full force of parental disapproval?"
Guy looked flustered, and Hal pressed his advantage. "The sole reason I have not been more severe in my condemnation of your brother's part in this is to spare the young lady's reputation and prospects. Do you wish to expose her now?"
"I will not have to tell anyone else why I am doing this, but I want to fight him."
"Well, then," Hal gave up, "if you are determined, and there is nothing more than I can say to persuade you, then fight him you shall. I will arrange a wrestling bout between the two..."
"No, Father," Guy interrupted. "You do not understand. I wish to challenge him to a duel with pistols."
Hal's expression hardened instantly. "What nonsense is this, Guy? Tom is your brother."
"I hate him," said Guy, and his voice quivered with passion.
"Have you considered that if you call him out, Tom will have the choice of weapons? He will certainly choose sabres. Would you wish to face Tom with a sabre in his hand? I don't think I would.
Abberley has turned him into a swordsman who can hold his own in any company. You would not last a minute against him. He would humiliate you or he would kill you," Hal told him bluntly and cruelly.
"I don't care. I want to fight him."
Hal lost his temper. He slammed the palm of his hand on the desk with such violence that the ink sprayed from its well onto the pages of the ship's log.
"That's enough! I have tried to reason with you. Now I forbid this notion of yours. There will be no dueling on this ship, and certainly none between my own sons. If there is one more word from you on the subject, I will have you chained in the forward hold,
and as soon as we reach Good Hope, I will have you transferred to another ship and sent back to England. Do you hear me, boy?"
Guy recoiled at the strength of his father's anger. He had seldom witnessed such fury from him. However, he tried to stand his ground.
"But, father, enough!" Hal snapped. "I have had my say, and the subject is closed for all time. Now get about your duties with Mr. Beatty. I will hear no more of this nonsense."
The sea changed in colour and mood as the Seraph tacked back and forth, battling her way steadily eastward. The confused and disordered wave formations of the ocean changed their character and became great serried ranks, an army of giants marching in battle array towards the land still hidden beneath the horizon.
"Ah, the Cape Rollers," Ned Tyler told Tom and Dorian and pointed ahead towards the misted horizon. "Cold waters meet in the warm African airs. Some call it the Cape of Good Hope, but others call it the Sea of Fogs, and others still the Cape of Storms."
Each day a sense of excitement grew stronger in the ship, which had been so long out of sight of land. The birds came out to meet them from the distant continent, gannets winging in long formations with slashes of black down their yellow throats, gulls with snowy breasts and sable mantles following with raucous cries, and tiny petrels splattering the surface of the water with webbed feet. Then they saw the first dark clumps of drifting kelp, torn from the rocks by the stormy seas and washed out by the current, waving their long stems and bunched fronds like the tentacles of deformed octopods. Vast shoals of small sardine-like fish seethed upon the surface of the cold green waters, and legions of slippery, glistening seals frolicked and fed upon this abundance. As the ship ploughed on, they lifted their heads to regard the men on the deck with huge swimming eyes and stiff, cat-like whiskers. Now each evening Hal shortened sail so that the ship was barely holding her own against the swirling green current. At first light he sent Tom and Dorian to the masthead to make sure that no reef or rock lay ahead to claw out the ship's guts. As soon as he was certain that the way ahead was clear, he shook out the reefs and clapped on all canvas. In the middle of the 73rd morning since leaving Plymouth Hoe, Dorian pointed out to his elder brother the cloud that stood stationary, dead ahead above the horizon, while the other heavenly cohorts tumbled and streamed away upon the wind. Both boys studied it for a while, until suddenly it swirled, opened, and they saw a hard blue line beneath it, straight as a sabre cut.
"Land," whispered Tom.
"Can it be?" Dorian asked wonderingly.
"Yes, yes," Tom's voice rose sharply. "It's the land!"
He leapt to his feet in the swaying perch and pointed ahead with a finger that shook.
"Land!" he shrieked. "Land ho!"
Below him the deck erupted into life. The watch below came streaming up and joined the scramble into the rigging. Soon every shroud and yard was clustered with men, hanging like bunches of ripe fruit, shouting and roaring with laughter and excitement. Hal Courtney came rushing up from the stern cabin in his shirt sleeves, clutching the brass barrel of his telescope under his arm, and climbed up to where his sons perched at the masthead. He climbed fast and strongly, never stopping until he reached the crow's nest. Tom noticed with pride that despite the long climb, his breathing was light and even. He lifted the telescope to his eye and studied the blue silhouette through the glass, picking out the shadowy seams and folds of rugged rock.
"Well, Master Thomas, you've made your first landfall," he handed the glass to Tom. "What do you make of it?"
Crouched between the two boys, he placed an arm around each of them.
"It's a mountain," Tom cried. "A great mountain with a flat top."
"Table Mountain," Hal agreed.
Tom did not yet realize what a feat of navigation this was. More than 70 days without sight of land, and his father had brought them in precisely on the 34th degree of south latitude.
"Look well upon this land ahead of you," Hal told them.
He felt a strange sense of prescience, as though the curtains that veiled the future had opened for an instant before his eyes.
"For this is where your destiny lies."
"Mine also, father,"
Dorian piped.
"Both of you. This is where fate has led you."
Both boys were silent, rendered speechless for once by their father's vehemence. The three sat together at the masthead while the sun reached its zenith.
"No need of a sunshot today,"
Hal chuckled. We can leave that to Ned Tyler and Alf Wilson. We know where we are, don't we? The sun started down the sky, and the Seraph plugged on gamely, beating her way slowly into the rushing southeast wind, gaining slowly so that the tabletop mountain rose with solemn majesty out of the sea until it seemed to fill the sky ahead of them, and they could even make out the white specks of human habitation at the foot of the sheer rock cliffs. "We helped build that fort," Hal pointed it out to them, "Aberley and Daniel and Ned Tyler and me."
"Tell us the story," Dorian pleaded.
"Oh, you've heard it 100 times, Hal protested. Tom added his entreaties. "It doesn't matter, Father. We want to hear it again." So, as they sat together in the rigging, Hal related to them the events of the war 25 years ago, how the entire crew of their grandfather's ship had been captured by the Dutch and brought in chains to Good Hope. Sir Francis Courtney had been tortured to reveal the whereabouts of the treasure he had taken from the Dutch galleons he had captured. When he had stood fast against his tormentors, steadfastly enduring the most vile and inhuman suffering inflicted on him, the Dutch had taken him out onto the parade ground and publicly executed him. Hal and the rest of the crew had been condemned to hard labour on the walls of the Dutch fort, and they had toiled and suffered there for 3 long years before they had made good their escape.
"So is that the mountain where Grandfather Francis is buried?" Tom asked. "Do you know where his grave is, Father?"
"Aberley knows, for it was he who took the body down from the scaffold in the night. Under a staring moon, he carried it up the mountain to a secret place." Tom was silent for a while, thinking about the empty sarcophagus in the chapel on the hill behind High Weald, with his grandfather's name graven upon it. He guessed what his father was planning, but this was not the time to thrust himself forward. He would bide his time. The Seraph came level with the small rocky island that guarded the entrance to the bay below the mountain. Forests of waving black kelp clogged the waters round it, and hordes of glistening seals thronged the rocky shore of Robben Island, so called because Robin was the Dutch name for seal. "Now I must go down to see the ship safely into the anchorage," Hal told them.
"Race you to the deck,"
Dorian cried as he sprang into the rigging. Tom gave him a lead and then flew after him. Their feet danced over the ratlines and they dropped as though falling free, but Tom was soon narrowing the gap between them until, when he was almost level, he slowed to let Dorian reach the deck a foot ahead of him.
"I won! I won!"
Dorian exulted. Tom ruffled his shining coppery curls. "Don't gloat," he said, and pushed him away. Then he looked at the small group in the Seraph's bows. Mr. and Mrs. Beatty stood there with all their daughters, Guy with them. They were animated and excited, pointing out to each other the landmarks of this famous headland next to Cape Orgullis, the most southerly point of the African landmass.
"They call the white cloud sitting on top of the mountain the tablecloth," Guy was lecturing the group. "And that little hill there to the south of the settlement is called Lion's Head. You can see the shape of it."
As always, he had studied the navigation books and knew all the details.
"Guy, why don't you go to the masthead?" Tom called to him, not unkindly. "You'll get a much better view from there."
Guy glanced coldly at him.
"Thank you, but I'm quite happy where I am."
He stepped a little closer to Caroline and began to turn away.
"No need to be afraid," Tom assured him. "It's quite safe."
Guy rounded on him.
"Are you calling me a coward?"
His face was suffused with blood, and his voice cracked with indignation.
"That's not what I said,"
Tom laughed, and turned on his heel to go to the helm.
"But take it any way you wish," he flung over his shoulder.
Guy glared at him, and mortification flooded over him. Tom had disparaged his courage, then dismissed him casually in front of the Beatty family and Caroline. Something snapped in his mind, and before he truly realised what he was about, he launched himself down the deck at a full run.
"Tom, look out!"
Dorian yelled, but he was too late. Tom was turning to protect himself, but Guy crashed into him with all his weight and momentum, while he was balanced on only one foot. It sent him reeling against the gunwale with such force that the wind was driven from his lungs. Guy leapt onto his back and threw a full armlock around his neck. All the boys had taken regular wrestling instruction from Big Daniel, and though Guy was slow and maladroit at the sport, he knew all the holds and throws, and now that he had this killer grip, he was making the most of it. He braced himself with one knee in Tom's back and used the counter-thrust of one arm against the crook of the other to block off Tom's windpipe and put the strain on his spine so that at any moment the vertebra must snap. Tom reeled about the deck, tearing at Guy's arms with desperate fingers, gradually weakening, his mouth wide open as he gasped for air. The crew came running to watch the show, hooting with excitement, stamping and shouting encouragement to their favourites. Then, above the clamour, a bull voice roared, "Backsro Klebby!" And Tom reacted instantly. Instead of resisting the hold that was dragging him backwards, he changed direction, throwing all his weight and strength into a back somersault. Guy found himself hurled backwards with such force that he had no choice but to release his grip and fling back both arms to break his fall, otherwise his ribs would have been stove in. Tom turned in the air like a cat and was on top of his twin before he hit the deck. As they crashed together into the planks, he drove down with both elbows and knees into Guy's chest and belly. Guy screamed like a girl and tried to double up to clutch his injured stomach, but Tom was sitting astride him, pinning him to the deck. He bunched his fist and took a full backswing to drive it into Guy's face. "Tom! No!" It was his father's voice, and Tom froze. The wild anger faded slowly from his eyes. He lowered his fist and stood up. He looked down contemptuously at Guy. "Next time," he warned, "you won't get off so lightly." He turned away. Behind him, Guy came to his feet, still clutching his stomach, and braced himself against one of the cannon. The watchers drifted away, disappointed that the show had ended so tamely. "Tom," Guy called, and Tom looked back. "I'm sorry," Guy said. "Let's shake hands, let's be friends." He staggered towards his brother, looking contrite and abject, his right hand outstretched. Immediately Tom grinned and strode back. He seized the proffered hand. "I don't know why we ever fought," he said. "I do," Guy told him, and the pathetic expression on his face changed in an instant to one of blackest hatred. Quick as a viper, he drew the dagger from the sheath on his belt. The blade was 6 inches of bright steel with a needle point. He held it at the level of Tom's navel and thrust hard, at the same time using his grip on his right hand to jerk Tom towards him with all his strength, trying to pull him onto the dagger. "I hate you!" he screamed at Tom, spittle spraying from his lips in the sunlight. "I'll kill you for what you've done!" Tom's eyes flew wide with fright, and he twisted violently aside. The point of the dagger scored his flank, slit open his shirt, and ploughed a shallow furrow in the flesh beneath. Instantly the blood burst out, soaking the cotton and flooding down his leg. Caroline screamed in a high, ringing voice, "You've killed him!" And a roar went up from the crew as they raced back to watch the sport. Guy knew that he had bungled the stroke, and he thrust and slashed desperately at Tom's face and chest. But Tom danced and dodged each thrust until, suddenly and unexpectedly, he leapt forward and slammed the heel of his left hand under Guy's chin. His twin's head snapped back, and he let go his death grip on Tom's right hand. Guy staggered back against the gunwale, blood oozing from the corner of his mouth where he had bitten through his tongue. He still held the dagger and pointed it at Tom's face, snarling, "I'll kill you!" His teeth were stained with his own blood. "I'm going to kill you, you filthy swine!" With one hand, Tom massaged his injured throat, but with the other he drew his own dagger from its sheath. "You make a fine speech, brother," he said grimly. "Now let's see you do the killing you boast of." He went after Guy, right foot leading, moving on his toes, the dagger weaving in his hand like an erect cobra, his eyes fastened on his brother's face. Guy retreated before him. Howell moved forward quickly, opened his mouth to shout at them to stop, but before he could utter a sound, Abeli was beside him and gripped his upper arm. "No, Gondwani." His voice was low but urgent, lost to all but Howell in the screams of the women and the howls of the men. "Never try to separate fighting dogs. You will only give one the advantage." "In God's name, Abeli, these are my sons. They are no longer children, Gondwani. They are men. Treat them like men." Tom jumped forward, the point of his dagger held low, and fainted for Guy's belly. Guy ran backwards, almost tripping over his own feet. Tom circled out to his right, and Guy backed away towards the bows. The men were scattered to give them space in which to fight, and Hal saw what Tom was doing. He was driving Guy as a sheepdog moves the flock, shepherding him into the bows. Tom's expression was cold and set, with no sign of emotion, but his eyes glowed as he watched his twin's face. Hal had fought many men, and he knew that only the most dangerous swordsmen had that cold menace in their gaze when they closed in for the kill. He knew that Tom was no longer seeing a brother, but an enemy to be destroyed. He had become a killer. And Hal was afraid, as he had seldom been for himself. He was afraid for Guy, but he knew that Abberley was right. There was nothing he could do to stop this now. He could not call Tom off. It would be like trying to call off a hunting leopard. Tom was still bleeding from the cut across his flank. The slash in his shirt flapped open to show the white skin beneath and the wound like a smiling mouth from which the red tide oozed. It dripped onto the deck and into his shoes so that they squelched with each step he took. But he was unconscious of the injury. All he saw was the man who had inflicted it. Guy came up against the rail. With his left hand he groped behind him, testing the oak timbers. The realization that he was trapped dawned on him, and the wild anger faded from his eyes, replaced at once by fear. He glanced quickly about him, seeking an avenue of escape. Then his fingers touched the shaft of one of the pikes in the rack below the gunwale, and the fear dissolved like sea mist at the coming of the sun. Fierce joy lit his features as he dropped the dagger and snatched the pike from the rack. In the face of the heavy spear with its barbed steel head, Tom dropped back a pace. Guy grinned at him, his mouth a bloody gash. "Now we'll see," he gloated, lowered the pike head and charged. Tom sprang back and Guy wheeled after him, thrusting with the long shaft well out of the reach of the dagger in Tom's right hand. He gathered himself and charged again. Tom dropped the dagger, hurled himself aside to escape the gleaming steel point, then leapt back before Guy could round on him and seize the oak shaft. They wrestled back and forth along the deck, with the shaft between them, thrusting and pushing, grunting and bleeding, mouthing garbled oaths and insults at each other. Eventually, Tom pushed Guy against the side of the ship until they were locked together face to face and chest to chest with the pike shaft between them. Slowly, Tom forced the shaft up until it was in line with his brother's throat, then put all his weight and strength behind it. Guy's back arched as he bent over the rail, the thick oak shaft under his chin. Fear was in his eyes again. He could hear the water gurgling along the ship's side beneath him, and his toes left the deck. He was going over, and he was no swimmer. Water terrified him. Tom's feet were firmly planted, but in a puddle of his own blood, slippery as oil. His feet shot out from under him, and he went down heavily on the deck. Guy was free, and he staggered to the shrouds on the foremast, gasping for breath, sweat soaking his shirt. He caught at the shrouds for support and looked back over his shoulder. Tom rolled to his feet and stooped to pick up his dagger, then went after Guy like a charging leopard. "Stop him!" Guy screamed in terror. "Make him stop!" But the clamour of the watchers was deafening, rising higher still with wild excitement as Tom ran in with the dagger in his hand and madness in his eyes. Guy turned and, with the strength of panic, leapt into the shrouds and began to climb hand over hand. Below him, Tom paused only long enough to clamp the dagger between his teeth, then followed him up. The audience on deck stood with heads thrown back. None had ever seen Guy in the rigging before. And even Hal was amazed at how fast he moved. Tom could gain on him only gradually. Guy reached the yard and scrambled onto it. He looked down and experienced a moment of giddy vertigo. Then he saw Tom's face below him coming closer as he raced up the ratlines. He saw the merciless set of his mouth and the blood that splattered his face and soaked his shirt. Desperately he looked up the mast, but his spirit quailed at the height to the topmast, and he knew that with every foot he climbed, the advantage passed more firmly into Tom's hands. There was only one way for him to go, and he crawled painfully out along the high yard. He could hear Tom coming after him, and the sound drove him on.
He could not look down at the rushing green water so far below him. He was sobbing with terror, but still he crawled on until he had reached the end of the yard. He looked back over his shoulder. Tom was a pace behind him. Guy was trapped and helpless. Tom checked and sat upright on the swinging yard. He took the blade from between his teeth. He was a ghastly sight, all splashed with blood, his face white and set with rage, and the shining weapon was in his hand.
"Please, Tom," Guy wailed. "I didn't mean to hurt you."
He threw up both hands to shield his face and lost his precarious balance on the yard. He teetered wildly, windmilling his arms, then leaned further and further outwards until, with a wild shriek, he went over, twisting and turning in the air, dropping free until he hit the water in an untidy tangle of limbs and went deep under. Tom sat rigid as the fog of killing rage cleared from his brain and looked down in horror at what he had caused. Guy was gone. There was no sign of him below the green surface, no head bobbing in the ship's long, creaming wake. He can't swim. The dreadful reality struck Tom so hard that he reeled on his perch. I've done it. I've killed my own brother. The biblical horror of the deed flashed through him. He leapt to his feet, stood tall on the high yard, and peered back along the wake. Then he saw Guy come to the surface, his arms waving and his cries faint and plaintive as those of a wounded gull. He heard his father's orders to the helm bellowed from the deck below. Heave her to! Launch a boat! Man overboard! Before the ship could even respond to her helm and turn her bows up into the wind, Tom gathered himself and sprang far out from the yard, head first. Arms stretched far out above his head, he arced over, his legs straight out behind him. He struck the surface of the ocean cleanly and went so deep that the dark waters closed around him and crushed his chest. Then he turned and struck up for the surface. He burst out waist high, the breath whistling in his throat. The ship was past him already, swinging her bows round and into the wind. He looked back along the path of the wake and saw nothing. But still he struck out overarm, swimming with all his strength, churning the waters behind him, hardly feeling the sting of salt in the long, shallow wound down his flank. He judged roughly how far back he had last seen Guy's head, paused and trod water, panting for breath, looking about him. There was no sign of his brother. Oh, God, if he drowns, I will never... He did not finish the thought, but sucked in a mighty breath, doubled over until his head was pointed at the bottom of the sea, kicked his feet high in the air, and slid smoothly below the surface. With eyes wide open, he saw only the green shot through with bars of sunlight, and swam downwards until his lungs craved air. He must turn back to breathe. Then he saw something below him, a blur of white and blue, Guy's shirt and jacket, turning end over end, lifeless as a piece of flotsam. With aching lungs, Tom swam on down until he touched his brother's shoulder. He seized the collar of his jacket and turned for the surface. Although he kicked out strongly, the drag of the limp body hampered him. The seconds stretched out into an infinity of pain. His chest burned, and the need to breathe consumed him. He felt the strength going out of his legs. His hold on Guy's collar slackened, and he felt him slip away. The greenness filled his head, and his vision faded, stars of light exploding silently in the darkness. "Be strong!" he screamed soundlessly at himself, then forced his fingers to close tighter on Guy's jacket and willed his legs to keep kicking. The light grew stronger, the green faded, and suddenly his head burst out into the air and the sunlight. He drew a deep breath that filled his chest to the point of bursting, then another, honey sweet. He felt it pervade his body, and the strength flood back. He reached down and grabbed a handful of Guy's thick, sodden locks and pulled his head out into the air. Guy was drowned. There was no life in him. His eyes were open, blind and staring. His face was waxen. "Breathe! For the love of God, breathe!" Tom shouted into his white, still face, and he seized him with both arms around his chest and squeezed. Abelie had shown him this trick, and it worked. The dead, stale air gushed out of Guy, mingled with gouts of seawater and vomit. It spewed into Tom's face, and he released his grip. Guy's chest expanded reflexively, sucking in air through his gaping mouth. Twice more, Tom squeezed the water out of him, fighting to hold his face clear of the surface. With the third breath, Guy coughed and choked, and he struggled to breathe of his own accord. His eyes blinked, still unseeing, then slowly focusing. He was breathing, but with great difficulty, racked every few seconds with paroxysms of coughing, but slowly expression returned to his eyes.
"I hate you," he whispered into Tom's face. "I still hate you. I will always hate you."
"Why, Guy? Why?"
"You should have let me drown. For one day, I will kill you."
"Why?"
Tom repeated.
"You know," Guy gasped. "You know why."
Neither twin had heard the boat approaching, but Hal Courtney shouted to them now from close at hand.
"Hold loud, lads. I'm here."
The crew of the longboat were pulling with a will, and at the tiller, Hal steered them in close. At his order, they shipped their oars, and strong hands reached down to seize both boys and drag them from the water. Dr. Reynolds was waiting at the rail as Guy was lifted aboard the Seraph. Tom stood next to his father on the deck and watched, strangely forlorn, as the surgeon's mates carried his brother below.
"He hates me, father," he whispered. "Let's see to that cut, lad," Hal said gruffly.
Tom glanced down without interest at his wound. The seawater had reduced the bleeding to a slow weep.
"It's nothing," he said, "a scratch."
Then he looked up again at Hal.
"He hates me. It was the first thing he said when I pulled him to the surface. What am I to do?"
"Guy will get over it." Hal ripped open Tom's shirt to get at the dagger cut. "He will forget and forgive."
"No, he will not."
Tom shook his head.
"He said he will always hate me. He is my brother. Help me, father. What can I do?"
Hal could give him no answer. He knew all too well the younger twin's obstinacy and tenacity. They were at once his strength and his weakness. He knew that Tom was right. Guy would never forgive him. It was the most beautiful landfall in all the oceans Hal had ever sailed. The mountain was a towering wall against the sky, and the wind sweeping over the top frothed like boiling milk into a soft, pulsating cloud, touched with shades of oyster shell and pink pearl, colours borrowed from the lowering sun. The slopes of the mountain below the rocky ramparts were green with forests, and the beaches were white, rimed with a frosting of surf. Such beauty should have delighted Hal. Yet every memory that crowded back upon him was touched with pain and horror. The walls of the castle were clear to see from this range, and on the crenellated battlements the cannon glared out at them, their muzzles dark, empty eye sockets. In the dungeons beneath those walls he had lived out 3 cruel Cape winters, and he shivered now at the memory of the cold in his bones. It was on those walls that Hal had laboured until the skin and flesh were torn from his palms, and he reeled with fatigue. It was on the builder's scaffolding that he had seen so many good men die, and there that he had made the difficult transition from boy to man. He lifted the telescope to his eye to survey the other ships at anchor in the bay. He was amazed at their numbers. He counted 23 sail, all big trading vessels, Dutchmen for the most part. He spotted one Englishman among them, another East Indiaman, from the look of her, but he saw with disappointment that she was not the Yeoman of York. There was no sign of his companion in the anchorage. Without lowering the telescope, he swept the waters of the bay towards the land. His eye stopped on the open parade below the castle's walls, and the memories of his father's execution flooded back to him in all their stark, terrible detail. He had to force them from his mind to be able to concentrate on bringing the Seraph into the anchorage. "We will anchor out of range of the guns in the fort, Mr. Tyler," he gave the order. And there was no need to qualify it. Ned knew his mind, and his expression was also sombre. Perhaps, too, he was reliving those days of horror as he put up the helm and gave the order to take in the canvas. The anchor went down with a splash that wet the forecastle,
and the cable smoked out through the hawser hole. Seraph snubbed up hard and then pirouetted gracefully with her head to the wind and became quiescent, transformed from a vital, living, straining sea creature to something lovely and tranquil as a drifting swan. The crew lined the Seraph's bare yards and hung in the shrouds, staring at the land, shouting comment, speculation and question as they watched the bumboats rowing out to meet them. Seamen called this fair cape the Tavern of the Seas. It had been colonized over 50 years before to serve as a victualling station for the fleet of the Dutch East India Company, and the bumboats were laden with all the things that a crew craved after 3 months at sea. Hal called his officers to him. "Watch that no strong drink is smuggled into the ship," he warned Alf Wilson. "The rum sellers will try to slip it in through the gun ports. We will have half the men puking drunk by nightfall if you let them hoodwink you." "Aye, aye, Captain," the fourth officer touched his cap. As a man of abstinence, he was a good choice for the duty. "Aboli, place men armed with cutlass and pistol at the rail. We don't want those thieving rogues coming aboard to strip the ship bare, nor whores plying their trade on the gun deck. Otherwise the daggers will be out," he'd almost said again, but stopped himself. He did not want to remind them of the conflict between his sons. "Mr. Fisher, you will do the bargaining with the bumboats. You're good at that." He could rely on Big Daniel to get his shilling's worth, and to check every piece of fruit and vegetable that came aboard. "Mr. Walsh will assist you and pay the boatman." Walsh had many duties, from schoolmaster to writer and purser. The officers scattered to the tasks he had set them, and Hal strode to the rail. He looked down into the bumboats as they came alongside. They were laden to the gunwales with fresh produce, potatoes with the earth still on them, green cabbages and apples, figs and pumpkins, sides of fresh red mutton and plucked chickens. The crew would gorge themselves this evening. Saliva squirted from under Hal's tongue as he looked down upon this cornucopia. This hunger for fresh food was a consuming lust that overcame every seaman at the end of a long voyage. Some of his men were already leaning out over the side and bargaining for the wares. Those with money paid as much as a halfpenny for a single fresh potato, a ludicrous price. They were frantic with greed, wiping the clinging earth off the fat white tubers against the skirts of their petticoats as though they were apples, then wolfing them down raw, crunching the astringent white flesh with every evidence of enjoyment. Dr. Reynolds came to Hal's side. "Well, sir, it's a relief to be in port again. 26 cases of scurvy on board already, but we will see those cured before we sail again. It's a miracle and a mystery, but the air from the land heals even the worst cases. Men who have lost their teeth and are too weak to stand," he handed Hal a ripe apple. "I stole a couple of these from Master Welsh's stock." Hal bit into it and had to close his eyes in ecstasy. "Oh, the food of the gods," he said, as the juices flooded his mouth and slid like sweet oil down his throat. "My father used to say it was lack of fresh food that caused the scurvy," he told the surgeon. Dr. Reynolds smiled pityingly and took a huge bite of his own apple. "Well, Captain, sir, no reflection on your sainted father, for all the world knows he was a great and good man, but ship's biscuit and salt beef is food enough for any seaman." Reynolds wagged his head wisely. "You do hear some marvellous theories from men not trained in the physic arts, but it's the sea air that causes scurvy and nothing else." "How are my two sons, Doctor?" Hal asked, changing the subject adroitly. "Thomas is a healthy young animal, and fortunately the wound was not deep and did little damage. I have closed it with catgut stitches, and it will be healed in next to no time. That is, if it does not mortify." "What of Guy?" "I have sent him to the bunk in your cabin. His lungs were flooded with salt water, and that sometimes breeds morbid humours. But in a few days he, too, should be none the worse for his ducking." "I am thankful to you, Doctor." At that moment there was a commotion amidships. Aboli had picked out one of the Hottentot lads who had carried a crate of fruit up the ladder from the bumboat alongside and grabbed his shoulder. "Hey there, pretty boy," he challenged. "Or are you a boy?" His victim had a heart-shaped face, flawless golden skin and slanted Asiatic eyes. He reacted to Abeli's challenge with a flood of high-pitched abuse in a strange tongue-clicking language and struggled in Abeli's great hands. Laughing, Abeli jerked the hat from his head and a thick black mane fell onto the fellow's shoulders. Then Abeli lifted him high with one hand and with the other jerked his breeches down around his knees. The crew let out a howl of delight as a plump yellow bottom was revealed and shapely thighs, between which nestled the dark, furry, triangular badge of womanhood. High in the air, the girl rained blows with both hands on Abeli's bald head, and when this had no effect on him, she clawed at his eyes with long, sharp fingernails and kicked wildly at him with both feet. Abeli walked to the ship's rail and tossed her over the side as effortlessly as if she had been a stray kitten. Her companions hoisted her back into the bumboat, streaming water, hoisting her breeches, and still shrieking abuse at the seaman who jeered at her from the rail. Hal turned away to hide his smile and walked across to where Mr. Beatty stood with his family around him at the foot of the mainmast, all of them gazing across at the shore and animatedly discussing this new land. Hal lifted his hat to the ladies, and Mrs. Beatty beamed with pleasure. In contrast, Caroline avoided his eyes. She had been shamefaced in his company ever since the night in the magazine. Hal turned back to Mr. Beatty. "We'll be anchored here for many days, possibly weeks. I must await the arrival of the yeoman, and there is much else I must see to. I am sure that you will want to take your family ashore, to give the ladies an opportunity to escape from the confines of their cabins and to stretch their legs. I know that there are comfortable lodgings to be had in the town."
"What a capital idea, sir," Beatty responded enthusiastically.
"I am sure it is no hardship to you, Sir Hal, but for us land dwellers the confined spaces on board become irksome." Hal nodded agreement. "I shall send young Guy ashore with you. I am sure you will want your secretary at hand." He was pleased to have achieved his most urgent purposes. First, to separate Tom from Guy, and second, to separate Tom from Caroline. Both situations could blow up like a powder keg at any moment. "I will have you conveyed ashore as soon as the boats are launched, although it is perhaps too late this evening." He glanced at the setting sun. "You might wish to pack your chest now and wait until tomorrow to go ashore."
"You are very kind, Captain," Beatty bowed.
"When you have an opportunity, you might be good enough to make a courtesy call upon the Dutch governor. Van der Stel is his name. Simon Van der Stel. I will be much occupied with the ship's management, and you will be doing me a great service by undertaking this duty on my and the company's behalf." Beatty bowed again. "With the greatest of pleasure, Sir Hal." It was over 20 years since Hal had escaped with his crew from imprisonment in the castle dungeons, and it was unlikely that anyone in the settlement would recognize him. But he was a convicted felon, with a life sentence hanging over his head. During the escape from the castle, he and his men had been forced to kill many of their jailers and pursuers in self-defense, but the Dutch might see it in a different light. If he were recognized, he might find himself before a Dutch tribunal charged with those crimes and facing the prospect of serving out his life sentence or even paying for his crimes on the gallows, as his father had. A formal call on the governor of the colony would not be a wise move. Much better to send Beatty. Then again, he must gather all the news available in the settlement. Every ship returning from the Orient, no matter its nationality, called here at the Cape. He could not hope for better intelligence than was readily available in the taverns and bawdy houses of the waterfront. He excused himself from the Beatty family and called Big Daniel and Abeli to him. "As soon as it's dark, we're going ashore. Have one of the boats made ready."
The moon was 4 days from full. The mountain loomed dark and monstrous over them, its gullies and bluffs touched with silver as they followed the shimmering path of moonlight to the beach. Hal sat between Abeli and Big Daniel in the stern sheets. All three were muffled with cloaks and hats, and they carried pistols and swords under their cloaks. The rowers were also armed, 12 good men under Alf Wilson. They came into the beach on one of the Atlantic swells, hissing over the sands on the foaming crest. As soon as the wave began to retreat, the rowers jumped out and dragged the longboat high and dry.
"Keep the men under your eye, Alf. Don't let them sneak away to look for drink and women," Hal warned Wilson.
We may be in a hurry when we return. They trudged together through the soft beach sand, and as soon as they found the path, they set out for the huddle of buildings below the fort. Some of the windows showed the glimmer of lanterns, and as they drew nearer, they could hear music, singing, and drunken shouts.
It has changed little since our last visit, Ubberly grunted.
Trade is still good, Big Daniel agreed, and stooped into the door of the first tavern on the edge of the settlement. The light was so dim and the fog of tobacco smoke so dense that it took a few seconds for their vision to adjust. The room was full of dark figures and the reek of sweating bodies, rank pipe smoke and bad liquor. The noise was deafening, and as they paused in the entrance, a seaman reeled past them. He staggered to the edge of the sand dunes, dropped to his knees, and threw up loudly and copiously. Then he toppled forward and fell face down in the puddle of his own vomit. The three men stepped together into the room and pushed their way through the throng towards the far corner, where there was a trestle table and a bench on which another comatose drunk sprawled. Big Daniel lifted him as though he was a sleeping child and laid him gently on the cow dung floor. Ubberly swept the clutter of empty tankards and platters of half-eaten food from the table, while Hal took a seat on the bench with his back to the wall to survey the dim room and the men who crowded it. They were mostly sailors, though there were a few troopers, in their blue jackets and white cross belts, from the castle garrison. Hal listened to their talk, but it was a drunken babble of wild boasting, cursing, and mindless laughter.
"Eh, Dutchman," Ubberly murmured, as he took his seat on the bench beside Hal.
They listened for a while. As a matter of survival, all three had learned to speak the language during their captivity. A group of five tough-looking sailors sat at the table beside them. They seemed less drunk than the others, but they were speaking loudly to make themselves heard above the din. Hal listened for a while, but heard nothing of interest. A Hottentot serving wench brought them foaming pots of beer. Daniel tasted his and made a face.
"Ah, piss! Still warm from the pig," he said, but took another swig.
Hal did not touch his, because he had just heard the Dutchman at the next table say, "We'll be lucky if the devil-damned convoy ever leaves this pestilent port." The mention of a convoy intrigued Hal. Traders usually sailed alone. Only in times of war or other emergency did they form convoys and place themselves under the protective guns of men of war. He leaned forward to hear the rest.
"Yeah, I for one will not weep if I never drop anchor again in the nest of black whores and thieving Hottentots. I have spent nearly the last guilder in my purse, and all I have to show for it is to saw a head and a raw pizzle. I say the skipper should take his chances and sail alone. To hell with this bastard Jangiri and his heathen crew. De Leopard is a match for any son of the prophet. We don't need to sit around here until Van Reuters is ready to nursemaid us."
Hal's pulse spurted at the name Jangiri. It was the first time he had heard it outside Nicholas Child's cabinet.
"Who is Van Reuters?" Big Daniel asked quietly, and took another pull at his poisonous beer. He, too, had been eavesdropping on the Dutch sailors. "The Dutch Admiral of the Ocean of the Indies," Hal told him. "He's based in the Dutch factory at Batavia." He slid a silver shilling over the dirty tabletop. "Buy them a pot of beer, Big Danny, and listen to what they have to tell you," he ordered. But as Daniel stood up from the bench, he found himself confronted by a woman. She stood, arms akimbo, and looked up at him with a seductive grin that lacked only a few teeth. "Come to the back room with me, you big bull," she told him, "and I'll give you something you've never had before." "Oh, what have you got, my darling?"
Big Daniel showed her his bare gums in a wide grin.
"Leprosy?"
Hal surveyed the drab swiftly and realized that she could be a better source of information than any drunken Dutchman.
"Shame on you, Master Daniel," he said, "that you don't recognize a lady of quality when you see one."
The woman ogled Hal, taking in the cut and quality of his coat, the silver buttons on his waistcoat. "Sit down, your ladyship," Hal invited her. She giggled and preened like a girl, pushing straggling grey strands back from her face with grimy fingers whose nails were broken and black-rimmed.
"Take a little something for your throat's sake. Daniel, get the lady a glass of gin.
No, no, let us not be mean,"
Get a full bottle.